My guest today is Adam Singer. Adam is VP of Marketing at AdQuick, which is an OOH advertising platform. And if you have no idea what the acronym OOH stands for, don't worry, I didn't know it either. Which is the exact reason why I wanted to chat with Adam. Well, that and his take on Twitter and social media in general. I mean, Adam is quite entertaining on Twitter and oftentimes even spicy. And I really wanted to dig into that a little. So check out our chat and let me know what you think. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tim Solo and you're listening to Ahrefs Podcast.
Ahrefs Podcast.
Hey Adam, thanks again for coming to this podcast. I'm actually super excited to talk to you. I've been following you for a while on Twitter and I feel we can have a very interesting discussion.
Excited to talk to you as well, Tim. And the feeling is mutual. I love reading your updates. You're with an awesome company and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Amazing. So yeah, there's so many things I want to talk about, but I guess we start with AdQuick. So you are currently VP of marketing at AdQuick, right? And whenever we were researching you, I came across a brand new term for me, OOH, out-of-home advertising. So AdQuick is a platform for out-of-home advertising. I never did that. So I'm really interested to dig into that. And I guess my first question would be, do SaaS companies use your platform to advertise themselves?
A resounding yes. So SaaS companies historically really love out-of-home advertising. There's an old joke. If you put together enough big enterprise company billboards, an airport will form around it naturally. We have SaaS companies, very large SaaS companies, big publicly traded, $100 billion SaaS companies, all the way down to unicorns and early funded startups that want to blanket all of Soma in San Francisco or certain parts of New York to reach venture capitalists or high value technology buyers in such a way that's larger than life, that shows staying power. I think for a lot of SaaS companies, when you are starting to do things like run billboards or do big sponsorships, it's really a signal to the market that you're not going anywhere, that you're a legitimate entity, that you're wanting to form relationships and service users over multi-year timeframes. You're not just someone who took on a bunch of venture capital and doesn't know what they're doing, but you're willing to make the investment in brand, which I think is an important signal, not just for marketing to marketers like you and I do, but probably even more so for a lot of the IT buyers to make them feel safer about making a big decision with their company's software. And for some things, the implementation is such a high investment up front that whatever you can do as a marketer to make that buyer feel safer is definitely something you want to do to help out your sales team.
My kind of first kind of acquaintance with out-of-home advertising for tech companies was probably this summer in London, because me and my wife were just standing at a bus stop in London and we saw a bus and I was like looking at the design, the wrapping of the bus, and I see some recognizable, you know, patterns and illustrations, and I'm realizing that it is an ad for Notion. And I was wondering, a bus in London, why would Notion promote themselves on a bus in London? So I'm interested to hear your thoughts, like, how do they come up with this decision, what it does for them?
The fact that we're even talking about Notion on our podcast shows that they're winning with their advertising. I think that when a company reaches a certain size, it's very American, first of all, to want to put your brand on a third place, whether that's a city or a sports arena or an airport or anywhere else. So it's out of home, a bus wrap. We consider out of home, even things like screens at a gas station where you're filling up your tank. I think marketers like to do bigger, larger than life stuff that gets their customers and their team hyped. I think bus wraps are actually very cool. If you think about it from a marketing perspective, they're actually moving around the city and traversing the landscape and getting in front of a whole lot of people in a way where you have to look at a bus. You're walking around the city so you don't get run over. The other thing to think about for out of home is, so I was at Google a long time and I've worked on a bunch of online ad tech companies, and almost no one takes a screen grab of a display ad and shares it. Maybe once in a while if it's super creative. But what I've seen since joining the out of home company is that consistently every day people take photos and videos with their smartphone of advertising that's outside, that's cool and creative, whether it's a bus wrap or something else. And we see it online every day, whether it's like the Diablo ad that went super viral in New York or the Las Vegas Sphere where people are doing crazy things.
I love Las Vegas Sphere. It's like my goal to someday advertise there.
Yeah, so out of home is this hack to do something in the real world that will get shared in the organic part of the internet. And so I think it's a fun space for brands. I think you had mentioned out of home is new for you. Truthfully, it was new for me too, because I'm like yourself, Tim, I'm a purist digital marketer first. And so I had run out of home ads in the past. In the old world, you would have to call like a whole bunch of different vendors, large and small. It was, imagine a pre-Google world, pre-GDN world, you would have to call like all these different web and media companies versus just using the GDN and saying, look, I have this much money, I want to reach this many people. And so we're trying to do the same thing for the physical world, which is bring together the large vendors like the Clear Channel and the Lamars, but then also the thousands of smaller owners of out-of-home media. So if you think about it, AdQuick is really just like the GDN, but in real life, where you can hit the whole universe of out-of-home or just the specific places you want the targeted buys through one platform. So I was excited to join because for us digital marketers, this is like the last thing that you couldn't do from an ad management tool. And now you can. So the future is here. If you're a digital marketer, you can run the whole show just from your laptop. And it's just crazy. When we started all of this, nothing was this easy with your product as well. You had to get all these disparate data points to understand how your company was doing in the search or social landscape. And now it's gotten to be a lot easier now. And I think the end state of all of this is letting your team be freed from all the annoying parts of marketing and all the sort of busy work to be able to just focus on the creative. And I think once you get there, you can start to have more bandwidth to decide, look, I want to tell this story, visualize in this way, and I want it to be consistent online and offline, and I want it to spread across organic and paid. And now we're focused on higher level strategic work, and we're not always thinking about very tactically of how do we just do these things.
Back to the bus in London, I wonder if you can give me just the ballpark of what it would cost to wrap, I don't know, one bus for, I don't know, a day or a week or whatever.
Yeah. So I would say for an out-of-home campaign on a bus, be prepared to spend about $50,000 minimum. And the reason isn't, you could in theory buy it for less time, but the issue is if you're going to go through the investment of making a bus wrap, you want that to be on the bus for at least, I would say at least a month or two.
You said 50K?
Yeah,
is 50K. Is it one bus for 1 month?
Yeah, probably. It might be as low as 20 or 25 in some places, but I wouldn't spend less than 50K on the bus.
But it gives you like a wrapping of a bus for 1 month. So 1 month, the bus is driving around with your ads on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, like I said, I'm new to out of home advertising. And I wonder if, so you said you have SaaS companies and tech companies among your clients, yep. Which is, I'm not surprised, obviously, because I've seen the bus with Notion. So I understand that companies do it. But I wonder if this was a consulting call and I was asking you for advice, which I am, what would you suggest Ahrefs to do, like to tip our toes in out-of-home advertising? So we didn't do any of it. So what would you suggest? And no, what city, what type, what budget? Like, how would you approach that?
Yeah, sure. So I don't think you need to start with a $50,000 bus. what you would do as a company that maybe hadn't tried out of home before is I would do a geofence test of a specific city with take your best performing online banners and online creative and run that geofenced in Chicago or LA or whatever city or London.
I like the idea of, you said geofencing, picking a dedicated location because it is easier to track the uplift of searches for your brand in that location. Do you use Google Keyword Planner for that?
Yeah, we built a tool that looks at Google Analytics, your Google Analytics data, search data, and also the performance of your ads. We have some proprietary data sets to be able to actually see how many people are even going through your ads via sampled mobile data. So we'll try and bring all that together and show you the search lift in a given location. We built reports that will, a few clicks, you can automatically get that data. You don't have to do any data analysis. We created this once, measure once, cut twice, so you can pivot it into ad quick so you can see for your company.
Yeah, I understand that most of my questions about our specific case of advertising Ahrefs with OOH would lead to it depends answer because, yeah. But still, I want to try to get some kind of general advice from you. For a typical location like that we want to geofence, what would be the budget that you think is viable and what kind of inventory would you suggest we go for, kind of to make it like an easy and common sense first step to try it out? So what would you suggest to do in this regard?
Sure. So if you've got a good budget, a fun
What's
city,
a good budget? A million or something? I don't know.
If you have millions, it'd be fun to run a Vegas campaign around one of the big search or marketing events in Vegas and basically have ads, have digital panels at the airport, have ads in the cab on the way to the airport, have ads on the strip, and then ideally also the sphere. Imagine and on the way to the conference. And so now everyone's talking about you at that event. Obviously, that would spend quite a bit of money. Maybe that's before, I don't know if you guys are going to be a big public company one day, but before that, spend some money. You could do something similar in New York or Chicago for quite a bit cheaper in Chicago. Or
what about 100K? Sort of, what can we get for 100K?
Yeah, you could definitely run. So with out of home, the sort of less in demand the city is, you can think of it like real estate, like out of home is priced like real estate. So if you're in a smaller city, like you're in, if you wanted to take over like Cleveland, Ohio or Cincinnati versus LA or versus Vegas, you would get orders of magnitude more screen time, maybe more focused impressions. You could get people on their way to work a few times versus just some people during a specific event. But I would say overlook your marketing calendar. And really, it's going to make sense to spend even in an expensive place if you're there's a big conference you're at or a big industry event or everyone's going to Mountain View to some Google events and you want to be in the physical world of everyone who's attending a competitive event or a big industry player event. I would say overlaying your marketing calendar would determine. And again, the prices of inventory are always going to be more expensive. Real estate and more in demand location is just like the London ads you mentioned are going to run a lot less than ads in maybe Austin, Texas, where I am, which is
in London, it would be cheaper than in Austin, Texas.
No, in London, it would be more expensive than Austin. Sorry.
Ah, more expensive.
So yeah, just think of it like real estate.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. When we're talking about inventory, so billboards is obviously the first thing that comes to mind. Buses is, for me personally, the second thing that comes to mind. So top five. So we have like billboards, buses. I would imagine buses is not even number two on this list. What are like the most kind of effective channels that give you the most reach?
Yeah, so there's everything from digital displays, there's traditional billboards, there's buses, there's now drone shows. You can book a drone show to put your ad in the mix with the organic content they do. I don't know if you've watched any Mr. Beast videos where he does that. Yeah. There's airplanes that pull banners behind them. There's cars that drive around, trucks. Uber has out of home in their network. We are integrating soon with some different types of screens in real life. out of home is really just anything that's not a TV, a radio ad, or a mobile.
Are the ads in cinema also considered out of home?
Yes. Like, do you have out of home as well.
Okay, so if people go to cinemas in a given location, I can buy inventory again through your tool instead of finding any agencies or going direct. I don't think even cinemas sell that directly, right? They work with agencies probably.
They plug into our tool as well. So we do have cinemas and movies to put inventory in. For the video ads, I think you have to buy those through like a CTV tool, but you can buy the screens that sell still ads you can put in through AdQuick. And we have partnerships with some of the other video display companies where if you can't buy that directly in product, we have a partnership so you can make sure you get that inventory too. So we're really comprehensive of the whole landscape of any screen that's not your personal screen.
Mm. So here at Ahrefs, even though we are not analytical and we're not big on attribution and our marketing isn't very much data driven, we eat our own dog food a lot. We use our software and we rely on our software to direct our marketing strategy. Like, of course, when it comes to SEO specifically, when it comes to what people are searching for, when it comes to digging into our competitors. My natural question to you is if you guys are eating your dog food, if you promoted AdQuick with out-of-home advertising, I want to hear that story.
Yeah, so we promote ourselves all the time. I think one of the more fun recent examples is President Biden had all of the electric car makers to DC. We ran an out-of-home ad that said, say Tesla's name in Times Square, and we put like an Elon tweet on the billboard and it got retweeted and went viral. This was over a year ago now, but basically we do ads like that all the time where we poke at or just comment on what's happening in current events with billboards. And the reason that we do that is to show how fast and easy it is to run out of home, which we're making it as fast and as simple as you would run a search ad or a Facebook ad. And so we want to communicate the speed to market of our product. And so one way we can do that is we can run just ads for fun that are just about things happening in the news. And so that's a tactic that we do quite a bit. We also do during events and stuff, we'll run like the AdQuick trucks. If you look at our blog, you'll see that we've run AdQuick out of home ads just to show that you can do this as a meta example. But I think the more fun ones are where we do things where we're just showing, where we're just using the technology to do something fun and it's brought to you by AdQuick. So almost making it organic content more so than buying an ad from AdQuick right now. And it communicates that, oh, that's how you get this inventory. You get it through AdQuick.
Are you running any out of home campaign like right now for AdQuick?
Oh, yeah. So we run programmatic for ourselves pretty consistently, where we use our audiences tool to select where our users are most likely to be. So that would be large cities. That would be places where there's people still commuting to work for the people who work in offices. And we're using our audiences tool quite a bit for ourselves. I think for any niche software or any startup, audiences is definitely the way to go. A lot of people aren't using audience tools, but I think when you start to think about out of home, similarly to the internet or similarly to as you're doing CTV, audiences are very important. I can't imagine running any sort of advertising right now without considering audience profiles. And the fact that you can do this with out of home through our tool, that would be like the one feature I'd say everyone should use when they're using our tool or running any ads. Can't imagine not using audiences.
I'm just wondering, an average, so throughout the year, like a typical average monthly spend without any specific campaigns, but like ongoing spend on out of home advertising without like thinking of holidays or like whatever, just on an average month, what do you think makes sense for you guys to spend? Or let's say a typical, let's talk about us. If you don't want to share your numbers, let's talk about Ahrefs. So to get this thing going and I don't know, keep reaching people efficiently. I don't know, commuters in London. I know London is full of SEO digital marketing agencies. So lots of people are probably commuting by underground or subway or whatever they call it. So this kind of thing to typical monthly spend? Is it, I don't know, 50K, 100K, 200K? What numbers are we even talking about? Can we get anything substantial for 20K per month?
Yeah, you can get some good value bets for 20K a month. For that kind of budget, I would say there's this bias of people wanting the sort of busy intersections and the things where there's probably a lot more ads. And what if you didn't do that? What if you did an intersection where it's like less busy, but it's like maybe there's higher quality stores, or it's like more of a cool, hipper neighborhood, and you might be able to get some inventory a bit cheaper, but it stands out more. It's hard to say without really looking at some of the data about who your buyers are. I'm guessing for you guys, what if some people do stuff like this where instead of being on your commute to work and like that path, it might be more expensive than maybe having some ads near maybe like bars or more social areas where you could do jokes like put SEO jokes into like nightlife, right? Mm. Like order in, this is a terrible joke, but just an example, order in It Depends at a bar or silly stuff like that. That's all I can come up with at the top of my head. But yeah, for 20K a month, you can definitely have some impact, and you don't need to have the big display of entering a city where you get off the airplane and it's the first thing. You don't have to have $1 million budget. I think that's something like our tool is letting people do efficiently, because we have, if you go to adquick.com/browse, there's basically a map of all of the out of home inventory you can buy. And you can see there's like hundreds of thousands of pieces of inventory. And it gets easier because we have tools. We have like programmatic tools where you can say, look, I have this much to spend per month, and hey, help me figure it out. And then we can follow, we can give you like a programmatic version where we will figure out your spend for you. We'll allocate it. We'll say this has a reasonable expectation of reaching your audience, and we'll do the hard stuff for you. Because again, just like if you have all the websites in the world in Google's ad tool, you might need some help from the machines, so you're not just killing yourself picking out inventories. I think as you spend more, it makes more sense to pick out specific big pieces of inventory like the Vegas Sphere. But if you just have a budget to spend, don't kill yourself. Just make great creative. Let us spend it for you, and we'll give you reports. And over time, you can see, you know, where the placements are. We'll give you photographs too. We have, if you request it, we'll take photos of your inventory that are high quality, so you can have them to share online. We can make it like as easy or as difficult as you want for how granular you want to be. I think if, you know, you're a search marketer listening to this, you'll know that's the same in any ad tool. Like, how much ad ops work do you really want to do? And once you know you're creative that's working and you've played with the tool, your ad ops team can get effective with it and do good reporting and know what's happening. So I think if you're just new to out of home, there's a learning curve. I used to say this when I worked on Google Analytics, like there's no easy button in Google Analytics. There's no easy button in AdQuick, but we will help you get to the point where you're efficient and proficient at it. And I do think it's an opportunity for digital marketers listening to add out of home to their mix, since there are tools like AdQuick now where you can do this and you can integrate it with the rest of your marketing. I think it's a growth area, and hopefully we make it easy.
Yeah, I would imagine among tech companies, probably is not as popular as Facebook ads or Twitter ads or Google ads. So probably there is like it's easier to stand out as a tech company among those like burger joints and all, compared to Facebook advertising where like all the tech companies are there.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So you keep mentioning the word creative. Like I said, I'm a big fan of doing kind of interesting creative things that people naturally talk about. I wonder if I can put you on the spot and have you recall some of the creative campaigns from your customers that made you smile personally, and or you thought that it was particularly kind of smart or funny.
Sure. So there's actually a really cool piece of creative that Lyft, you've heard of Lyft, they're the Uber competitor. They did a campaign on the freeway in LA, where specifically there's a lot of traffic, and it had a ton of text. And it basically, the gist of it was saying, if you're reading this, you're probably in a Lyft. And it was a campaign about why you should use Lyft or Uber, but it was long and it was like, It was just funny because it was in traffic specifically for Lyft riders about like how Lyft, I think it was about how Lyft is better than Uber. And anyway, it was just done really creatively. There's also been some where there's been some really cool ones with, I don't know if you saw, I mentioned this earlier, like Diablo did one in New York that said, "Welcome to Hell," like in the middle of summer where it was really hot. And there was like one day where there was like all the smoke in New York. And so someone took a picture of the ad and it literally looked like hell. Obviously wasn't intentional with the smoke, but it was done over the summer because it's hotter in New York.
This was probably one of those like timely campaigns when you're saying you can launch something like really fast. You see something happening and what, like kind of the next day or maybe the day after you can have your ads running. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We also saw, like when we were doing some research, we also saw your April Fool's joke about Sky Ads, where you promised your customers or your audience to turn clouds into billboards. So tell me more about this kind of April Fool's, whatever, joke, marketing campaign or whatever. Like, who came up with it? How did people react?
Yeah,
I'm just interested.
So we actually just did a poll on our internal Slack of a bunch of ideas that the team members at our company came up with. And that was the most fun and whimsical one that the team liked. At heart, we're a marketing company made out of marketers. So we like to source our own team's ideas when we come up with things. Thank you for referencing that. I thought it was fun too. Maybe in the next wave of when we're all wearing augmented reality glasses everywhere, you can have ads like that, right? So
did you track anything in regards to the, did you promote this campaign like with ads or something, or was it just like a blog article on your blog?
No, that was just a April Fool's joke. So the tech industry has likes to do roundups of all the fun things that happen on April Fool's. I think Google is the one who started doing this years ago, where all the tech companies do different jokes. And we want to also be part of that. And I think there's no downside to a SaaS company participating in that annual tradition. I think for a while, people were tired of it. And now people expect it. And it's something fun that everyone covers. So the tech industry should take itself less seriously sometimes. And so I think April Fool's is a fun thing. Some people are tired of it and don't want to see any more April Fool's jokes, but I don't think there's any harm in it.
So that was a blog article, but how did people learn about it? So how did you promote it? Did you send it to your list of customers, or did you advertise it with digital ads, or what did you do?
No, we just shared that out organically in social and to our media friends and to via email to our users, noting it's a joke. We don't want to promise things we can't actually deliver.
You also did the so-called, at least we call it like that in our marketing department, brand video ad, where you do creative video explaining like what your product does and you try to use that like some funny situations or something. So our brand video ad didn't quite come into fruition because the lady from the agency that was doing it suddenly disappeared. I'm not sure if she had like health problems or something. Yeah, but she sent us the like almost finished video and we had three part kind of video series and then she just disappeared. But yeah, yours was pretty interesting, but it was on the longer side. It was like 3 minutes or something like that.
It is.
So tell me more about this brand video ad or however you call it. What was the strategy behind it? How did you use it? And what did you get out of it?
Yeah, the strategy around that was really to give a metaphor for out of home. And so we went with people in a rehab session. And basically, we were trying to rehabilitate marketers who are still running out of home by getting on the phone and sending faxes, but still getting on the phone and booking things over email instead of using an actual platform. And we wanted it to be have a positive angle. So we showed peep marketers basically getting excited and happier as they saw that there was a way to do the thing that they were doing now that was really annoying in a much easier, more efficient, codified way. And I thought—
Did you go with an agency to produce that?
Yes. So a local agency here in Austin helped bring the ad to life. Couple fun things. Chris Gaddick from our company is actually in the ad. he's at the table. And we did a 3-minute version for the website to tell the story in long form. We also made 15 and 30 second versions for social pre-roll and for YouTube ads, as well as CTV. So we wanted to tell the story across mediums. The reason that we did a high quality live action shoot with real actors is because we are advertising to advertisers. And so we need to communicate to advertisers that we take their craft seriously. And so if we had done a cheap, just stock photo only video ad, they would have seen us as a cheap, maybe stock commodity like company. And that's not what we are. We're a premium software as a service company that you actually get dedicated account help running out of home, because we talked about it is a more expensive medium, and running high quality ads that have the feel of an ad from a big company, I think was necessary to communicate in kind to advertisers that we pay all homage to their craft. We take it seriously. And so that's why we have a 3-minute cinematic version on the website. Also, someone who chooses, I think enterprise software decisions, because we are enterprise software, are taken seriously. And so I think there's probably like a barbell strategy if you do have a free tier or lower cost tier and a more expensive tier. But we're mostly just selling to like larger agencies and larger companies. So we found this to be true because I've gotten a lot of good feedback on having that video on the site, that they're willing to sit through a 2-minute, 3-minute video to understand our story. If they're going to spend, like I said, campaigns start at generally 50K, they'll spend that investment up front. So that's the reason that ads there. I'm running shoulder form versions of it, but I wanted to make sure that we didn't skimp on the storytelling there. And I also wanted to make sure that people spend a little bit more time with us in advertising, on a podcast like this, on our blog, somewhere before they actually talk to a salesperson, so that hopefully some of that trust can already be built. And then when they're talking to a salesperson, there's that much less effort that needs to go. They're already sold on it. They're just like, what's like the best way to proceed to get started?
So our video, which didn't end up being produced, cost us, I think the full cost was maybe 80K, up to 100K, but we paid half and then they disappeared. So we didn't pay the other half, obviously, because we don't have the product. I wonder what you paid for yours in Austin to an agency. Was it like some big agency or smaller one?
We paid around what you paid for your ad. So I would say that the cost of a high quality ad is probably not going to be under 100K for live action, where you're hiring actors, where you're building a set. You can go cheaper. You could use AI. You could use stock photos and videos. I think the AI ads are getting a little bit better, but it depends, because I could make an AI ad right now. And the thing is, it has to be good enough that an advertiser doesn't think I went cheap on it, because I'm advertising to advertisers. But for the rest of you, you might be able to get away with cheaper ads now. If you spent 80, 100K on an ad, I would say, Tim, don't have sunk costs. Like, either finish that one or make a new one. But I think a video ad is like a pretty good touch point along your customer journey. And just for you to have it to show at events before you give a talk, I'm like, I'm super bullish on every SaaS company having at least one marquee ad where you tell the story in a longer format. Just for, there's a type of buyer that will come to your website and just doesn't want to read anything, but they'll watch a video. Just for that person, it's like totally worth it to have a cool video. And it doesn't have to be something that's overly produced. I think especially if it's your first video, done is better than good, ship something. I think you spend more and you want to spend more as your ambition and budget grows. Because if you think about it, if you're going to spend millions or tens of millions on actual media buys for your ad, the cost of it starts to make a lot more sense to spend a bunch on, because now the economics are like way better if you think about cost per view that you're actually charging to get in front of someone. But it really depends.
Yeah, I have a kind of relevant story from my DJ days. In previous life, I was a DJ in the nightclub. And there was a time we wanted to promote some party. Was it like a Women's Day or maybe Valentine's Day, something like that? And we wanted to rent a truck, put some like DJ equipment and speakers there, and print some banners that we are having this party like this weekend and something, and drive this truck around town And as we were like having a meeting with our like club's promo team or whatever and calculating the costs, they started arguing if we should hire this truck for 3 hours or 4 hours, because like we had to pay hourly. And this was similar. I was like, come on, guys, we're going to print the banners. We're going to load all the equipment. We're going to have myself as a DJ. We're going to have some of our dancers there. So we have to pay to everyone for all this setup. And now you're being thrifty about not letting it run for one extra hour, while the costs of running it for one extra hour are nothing compared to the actual investment to even get this truck going. Long story short, we didn't end up doing this at all, because making like a nice looking truck and like driving it around town, and I guess we even had to have like permissions from our like local government or something. But yeah, I do agree with you. If you're planning a kind of a large scale advertising campaign, it does make sense to invest more in the actual creative, because for every view that you would pay, you would have a high quality creative, and like it brings the overall kind of effectiveness and the cost of the thing down, essentially.
It's exactly right. No one runs a cheap Super Bowl ad, unless the Coinbase actually is the only brand to take a real risk with their Super Bowl ad and just run that QR code on screen, but you could, only one person can do that, and they did. And that's a big risk, though. It could have gone the other way for them.
Back to analytics and attribution. What can you tell me about the analytics and attribution part of this video and promoting it around? Did you track the ROI of your spend and such?
Yeah. So for B2B, for video attribution, you would think of it similar to PR almost, where it's very difficult to track from any sort of news story or a video or a podcast sale. You do get some direct conversions when you're running the shorter form video ads. And so those you can track. I also sent that video as part of nurture campaigns to people who have been to our site and signed up. And so I'm not concerned with any one touch point. Maybe it's a search ad where it's like a textured ad. That is heavily down funneled, performance based, sure. But like for video as a tactic, I don't need it to bring me customers that convert and pay money today. I'm using that as a broader awareness story and as a touch point along the way. So when someone is ready to buy, they're that much closer to actually ready to run out of home than if they hadn't seen the video. So I think of it as definitely in terms of like the attribution, way upper funnel, somewhere that's going to be upper to mid funnel as one of several touch points before they're going to actually give us money. And I think that I worked on Google Analytics for a number of years. I would say there's probably between 10 and 12 touch points that you could expect for a B2B company with your brand before they actually become a customer. Touch points could include email, phone call from sales, video, PR, a tweet, a blog post. It's probably going to be 10 to 12 before they actually give you money. If you're selling something like nuclear submarines to a government, it's going to be a lot higher. But if you're selling software, that's going to impact your company. Don't put pressure on a certain tactic to be something it's not. So you wouldn't, a lot of companies are like, well, I'm updating LinkedIn or I'm updating X Twitter or I'm posting to whatever platform and it's not getting any customers right now. And that's not the point of that platform. Almost no one, even the ads in those platforms don't necessarily bring you someone who's ready to buy right now. People aren't there in the mindset of I'm ready to spend money on software. They're gathering information. Those just aren't conversion oriented channels. And so the more you try to force them to be, I think the more people are just going to not like you online because now you're just shilling. And I'm not saying you can't share your product, but what are the benefits of it? And typically when you show like the benefits and the use cases, they'll get thinking about it. They'll share a link to their team. And then later on, they'll Google you and convert from that. And they'll probably not convert from that social link. So that's what I mean when I think about, when I say I see it as like upper and mid funnel, I'm not counting on it to drive conversions right now. I don't need to tag every link in something like social. I don't need to worry about people coming to the site from video, right? These are things like, if I ever got those questions, like when I was on the consulting side, I'd have to have like come to Jesus conversation with my marketing team, be like, why do we think this? Why do we want this from this tactic? And it's just like a emblematic of probably not a great strategy in place. That's how I think of it it's not like pure faith-based, but it's definitely, let's get this to as many people as possible and let's put this in front of my users as part of their journey, and it will work its magic if it's a good piece of proof.
You didn't really talk about measuring the impact, even like self-attribution. I know some high-ticket customers, oh, if like your video converted me. Did you get any of that?
Yeah, I definitely collect more qualitative feedback as well from users. My challenge now is we've been running this creative for a year, is next year I'm going to make a new piece of creative. And so my benchmark is to perform against the existing creative. And that's, if I make a new video and I run a new test, it should perform better. And so the metrics that I would share with would be, the way to test video is really with YouTube ads. And so this current video gets a minute 40 views on average. Like, we perform better than like YouTube says we're performing in like the top 99% of video views because we're targeting pretty specifically. Yeah, I think for us, it's make great creative, make sure it's not getting skipped, make sure we're getting good feedback from users that it's resonating. And I see how all of our different marketing channels are working when we do retrospective analysis. I think our video is performing pretty well. Video, search, social, email all perform pretty well for us. Social, Twitter, LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and Instagram, almost nothing for us. So it's just, those aren't channels where people are there to figure out software buys. So they just don't make sense.
Yeah, I like how you measure those kind of performance metrics or indicators that are unique to a given piece of content or creative, rather than trying to measure the actual attribution. So if you have a video, you can see if people who are watching it are engaged, if they skip it on YouTube. And if you produce a better video, you can see those metrics go up. You're doing something right. And you're specifically measuring the quality of that piece of marketing. Let's call it like a piece of marketing, rather than trying to necessarily measure conversions or how it influences your kind of multi-touch point funnel, which I think is more or less impossible. So let's talk more about how you do marketing for AdQuick. So we started from discussing how you eat your own dog food and do out-of-home advertising, but I would imagine this isn't your biggest marketing channel. So how would you grade your marketing channels, I know, by their efficacy or like by the amount of effort and time you invest there, or just generally, how does your marketing look like for that product?
Yeah, I would say search is a really big channel for us. So I mentioned,
what kind of things are people searching for?
Yeah, so I mentioned my colleague Chris. He runs growth for us, and he's responsible for all of our search campaigns. He's a user of your product. And so search performs really well for us because people query, how much does a billboard cost in San Francisco? Mm. How much does a billboard cost in New York? And so one of our more effective link building campaigns are, we have public tools to show how much a billboard costs in a given city. And so you can find out, you know, the average CPM, you can find out the cost of specific locations. We also have a map of all of the world where you can drill down into locations. And we also built some marketing budgeting tools. So you can, you know, I mentioned that companies spend like 8% of their marketing budget on out of home. Like, we'll help you build a budget that includes out of home. If you want to give us your other inputs, we'll make it pretty for your team. We did a bunch of things just to help marketers on the tool side. You're super familiar with that when it comes to out of home. And so those are things that a lot of them are like standard toolkits in marketers' toolboxes when they're doing planning for the next year, when they want to, you know, understand what they want to allocate to. We have quite a few free open tools. You don't even need to advertise with us to use them. They're like purely organic inbound marketing for us. They rank well in search. We also do email. I think email is probably the second best channel for us behind search, in that we have, you know, to use a lot of our tools, you do have to enter an email address. And so we tend to market to them over time via email. We don't shill to them to sell. We just give them thought leadership, best practices. We try to add value to their inbox. I think for a lot of marketing tools, they're just like, buy now, give us more money. And I'm like, well, they'll give us more money when they're ready if we add the right value to them and we establish our credibility. We also do, you know, social. We do a podcast as well. I think, you know, we filmed, I think, 30 episodes, and now we're getting over 1,000 downloads or 1,000 downloads of views per episode, which is pretty good for,
it the Madvertising podcast?
The Madvertising podcast, yeah. So
that's it. Okay.
Yeah. And so we tend to do what you're doing. We tend to talk to people in our industry about what they're up to. So, you know, that's more of a just value add thing. We're not, again, it's not really about us, just like yours isn't. You guys aren't shilling your tool the whole time. But I think it's okay to work in your own tools. I think people also want to hear what you're up to, and you guys should have some have like a product person on at some point and talk about, you know, how you think about what you build.
We actually are shilling our tool the whole time. I challenge you to go to our blog and find at least 3 articles where there would not be a single screenshot of Ahrefs interface.
Nice. You put like the number of like inbound links and everything like right in the blog post, which is super cool.
Yeah. We like every article on Ahrefs blog is heavily featuring our product. But yeah, like it's interesting that you say that SEO is actually a big channel for you. And you said like your free tools are helping you out to get traffic and probably to get backlinks. I wonder what other SEO tactics or strategies you're using. Or what kind of, I don't know, interesting SEO tips and hacks you have for our audience, because a lot of listeners would be audience of Ahrefs who are doing SEO. So I wonder, like, if you have anything interesting to share along the lines of SEO.
I mean, the boring answer is what everyone does. We also create, you know, useful content for industry. Yeah, everyone knows to do that. So a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I used to do SEO. And I think that probably the best thing that we do is like, you know, Chris and I are also writers. And so we write op-eds and contributed industry pieces on industry trades and in like fast company type sites. And they're not like the stories that we write aren't, you know, 5 ways to run out of home better. They're like provocative about the industry. And I think that's something that we do uniquely, because Chris and I have strong opinions held strongly about how the marketing industry should work. You know, you've read my tweets and blog posts. So I think like that's something that we do where it's not like an exercise in link building, but because of that, it actually generates links. So a lot of the things that we do that are provocative do get attention. And those stories, even if they're not on our site, we'll get a bunch of links, and they've got a link to our site on the story itself. So there's pass through. I would say if you wanted to just talk shop on all of the link building stuff, you should have my colleague Chris Gaddick on. But for me as VP marketing, I'm not like counting the links that my team is generating on a monthly basis. Chris probably is, but I'm more looking at, you know, are we shipping consistent, you know, marketing assets and ideas. And, you know, if we do that, we're at a point where there's been enough, like AdQuick was started in 2016. So we're not like if we write something, create something interesting, we have enough authority in the eyes of the engines to rank pretty well. Like we deserve to rank for that content. Mm-hmm. So I think like it's less of a sit down and brainstorm, what can we do for the search engines? It's more of a, you know, we're the blessed point of, what can we do for our users? And that will end up ranking. So that's really what you want to get to as a startup. You know, you want to be able to create a story with a keyword for your sector, and it just ranks, you know, on the first page of Google. And of course, you have to grind it out to get there. I did ask my SEO team if we could credit one thing, it would be all the free tools that we have on our site for like the initial traction, for our site had the authority to link for, you know, all the various things we want to link for that bring in revenue.
So when you were saying that the articles that you write for other websites that help you with links, which is essentially guest posting or guest blogging, right? So you publish articles on other sites. How does it happen? Do you see sites, because you said you talk about marketing, do you see sites in the marketing niche, I don't know, maybe Adweek or something like that, and you pitch them your article? Or are you at a stage where those sites will reach out to you and invite you to contribute a column or something like that?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So we reach out and we're published in like Fast Company and other sites that have asked us to do op-eds. And then when we have news, our PR team pitches the various ad weeks and ad industry trades to write up stories. But I know this is boring for you guys, but I'm not really doing that stuff for link building. I'm doing it for marketing and awareness. And I tend to think like the link building happens organically at this point for us. Again, that's like not the thing that you'd say if you're like a day zero startup. You definitely need to be like, look, I need to claw my way for links. But like if I get a press story or an op-ed piece and the editorial site like strips out my link, like I'm not going to pester them. Some SEOs on this call would be like, no, email them, ask for a link. And I'm like, we're just not at that point and I don't really need to bother them. But I understand and empathize with companies that do need those initial links. I've been there before. I mean, I've been at much earlier stage startups too. I think it depends what stage you're at. And once you get to be big enough, you're just going to annoy people. You should just go about your marketing. And if there's one you really want and, you know, you're friends with that reporter, journalist or whatever, and you can ask them, cool. But don't ruin a relationship for a link. It's just not worth it.
So since you mentioned that we don't shoehorn our product enough in our content, let me do just that. If any one of the people listening to this want to dig into that guest posting and PR strategy that Adam is doing, Adam and his team is doing, we actually have a great tool for that. It's called Content Explorer. So what it can do, you can search for mentions of AdQuick all around the web. And if you search for AdQuick in Google, it would bring you pages from AdQuick. But what you can do in Ahrefs Content Explorer, you can basically get maybe 90% of all the pages published online with AdQuick in them. Or you can search for Adam's name, because we have like author semicolon parameter, and you can search for Adam's name, and whenever we can identify that Adam is the author on a given page, we would show you all the published guest posts under his name. So this is very cool, because if someone like we just said, if someone has a brand new startup, a brand new company, and they need to figure out where they should be posting their, I don't know, thought pieces or like pitching their stories, this is a great way to create a list of such websites. And it's not limited to AdQuick. You can do this with any competitor of yours that is like a few years ahead of you. And you can see what kind of, I don't know, guest posting, thought leadership and PR they were doing, which websites they were appearing on. So here goes the plug of one of Ahrefs' tools.
It's a great tactic to follow your competitors, especially like with media. If a certain reporter was covering your competitors in the early days, it's likely to expect they would be interested in you as well. So I like that tactic a lot.
Let's talk more about the marketing that you're doing for AdQuick, actually. We discussed that SEO is a big part of that. Free tools are a big part of that. And you're doing email marketing, but email marketing is more so for people who sign up for an account, or you have a separate email list of people who are not necessarily your customers.
Yeah, our email list is current customers as one segment and then prospects as another. So to access a lot of the tools on our site or certain features that are free, you do need to give us your contact information.
Mm. So, and you have email nurturing sequences for people who sign up as customers and people who sign up as prospects.
That's right. And I also write notes to our list. Like we have our nurture sequence, but I'm also a blogger. So I just write like Thursday and Friday notes to our users where I just send them cool stuff too. And one thing that I do that you can do as well, if you like to talk to my users in a conversational way, is like my notes aren't in like a fancy template that looks like it's an email newsletter. Like I literally just write a note to my list like it's an email. And the response rate on those is actually a lot higher than the ones with templates. So it depends what you want to do. I like to make it like really conversational. And like, I even let people, like anyone can reply to me, and I take replies from CMOs all the way down to media buyers. I'll only answer their questions, and I'll make sure that they get the help they need, not even just on AdQuick, but on like their marketing overall. Like they might like sometimes like they'll even send me links to, what do you think of this, Adam? And I'll give them thoughts. So I try to just add value. I think that since I'm a marketer selling to marketers, I can do that. If you're a marketer selling something where you're not in it all day, every day, that might be harder to do. If you're selling nuclear submarines, it's probably, you might not know as much, but for me, it's like a fun thing to do because I've been marketing to marketers for a while. So I'll just send notes to inspire people for the week. And I'll be like, hey, let me know if you have questions. And yeah, I've even helped like some people get jobs that sent me notes back.
How big is your marketing team at this point?
So it's myself and Chris Gaddick, who I mentioned, lead marketing. I also have a design resource. I have some engineering resource internally. I have analytics resource since we have an analytics product. And then I have a couple contractors that I use. But we're a scrappy team since we're, I think AdQuick is around 40 people right now. So we're not like a big sprawling enterprise. So yeah, and with AI tools and with agencies and contractors, I don't need a big marketing team to get a lot done. So I think that like I've worked with, I was at Google before and I was at some life science firms and some other type of companies where there was like a dedicated email person and a dedicated analytics person and a dedicated social media person. And yeah, you can run a team like that if you have infinite resources, but if you're a scrappy startup and you're venture funded, you're probably going to end up doing a lot of those yourself or building processes for it and either outsourcing or automating a lot of it. And then you pick and choose the things that you want to do manually. So like when I send notes to my users that are from me, like I'm writing that and that's like a very intimate, heartfelt thing. And I'm trying to build some relationship and permission with them. And yeah, we're a pretty scrappy team. Hopefully we can hire more people in the future. If you're listening to this and out of home sounds interesting to you, reach out.
Wait, but right now there's only two people with marketing in their title, essentially.
Yeah, it's really me and Chris doing all the marketing.
Whoa, you guys are very prolific and you still have time for marketing analytics and marketing attribution. How does this look like in your company?
So I have an analytics team internally that does analyst work for AdQuick users that we have white glove service where you can basically pay a little more and we'll do your analyst work for you.
Do you have things there like quarterly planning or like quarterly reports to your, I don't know, CEO? How does this look like? What do you report on?
Yeah. So we use a combination of tools and we have tracking to revenue through Salesforce Cloud. And so all of our internal reporting is pretty automated and doesn't take a whole lot of work. These would be questions for Chris who built our systems. But I think since we've been a lean team, we've pretty much automated all the data pipes. So if you were a new team member, Tim, and you wanted to come in and see how something was performing, we're like pretty socialized throughout the org. You can go into our dashboards and be like, oh, here's how sales are looking this quarter. Here's what's in the pipeline. Like all of that data is actually socialized to the whole team.
Okay. Free tools is a marketing tactic or strategy, whatever you call it, that you said is helping you out tremendously. How does it look like in analytics, in attribution? What do you know about this strategy from that standpoint, like hard cold numbers?
Yeah, I would say like hundreds, if not thousands of new links a year from our tools alone. It's definitely a question for
new
Chris,
links,
but
if we're talking about sales.
Yeah, probably we're doing between 30 and 50K unique visitors per month to the site. I think the free tools are definitely what help us rank well and get upper funnel traffic. Just from a competitive standpoint, I'm not going to give you numbers of like actual dollars, but it's definitely worth the investment if you're a SaaS company and if you have proprietary data or you can build models based on your data without sharing anything internal. I think it's pretty well worth the investment to be able to give some customer facing tools, whether that's a calculator, whether that's a projection tool, whether that's a industry benchmark tool. There's all sorts of cool things that SaaS companies can do, depending on how you structured your contracts and whatnot. We did this at Google. If you use Google Analytics, all of your data was, you basically agreed to share aggregate anonymized data
with the industry and Google. And so we built attribution tools, and we built like a state of the industry report for analytics that we shared with the Think with Google site. So it's pretty standard that if you use like a SaaS tool on the free or low paid end, even on the high end, if you don't opt out or you do opt in, that data gets anonymized and aggregated. So yeah, I'm bullish building tools. I've never seen it not be an effective tactic.
So how much metrics and numbers and marketing analytics went into the decision-making of creating those free tools versus intuition and gut feeling?
Yeah, I think if you're a startup, you're going to galaxy brain yourself and spend all this time into, oh, here's some data to justify something versus, can we just build it and see what happens?
Okay, so you went the let's build it and see what happens, and it gets traffic, and you understand that it's very relevant, so it likely converts. And let's say you even know that, I don't know, 7% of people landing on those free tools sign up for kind of the prospect account where you then nurture them with emails. What next? How do you use those numbers to, I know, further improve those tools, or do these numbers somehow participate in launching more tools? Tools work. Like, you, why would you even care to measure any attribution? So we at Ahrefs, we also have quite a few free tools. They send us a shitload of traffic, and we don't bother. If we have ideas of what other tool we can launch and we have resource for that compared to working on our product that brings us money, we just create this tool and leave it there. We don't bother to measure anything about it. We just know it should be helping.
Yeah, I think we think about the same way. If you ever want to have Chris on the podcast, he can tell you the specific numbers. But as VP of marketing, I take your perspective. I see we're getting tons of upper funnel traffic and links from it. I'm not going to, if we want to build new ones, cool. It's just helping you. So these are like, I think if you're at a SaaS company and you have a cool idea for a tool as like a product marketing manager and you propose it and they're like, no, I don't want to do this. Like, they suck. It's like everyone from HubSpot to Marketo to every big SaaS company has built free tools. And this is such a great marketing initiative for us. It's categorized under the be useful category, where it's like every SaaS company that's loved is, if you're going to build things for free that are useful, imagine how great the things that you're paying for are going to be, right? Yeah. You're just telling the market, hey, we know how to build cool stuff. And it's like the engineering lift isn't that high. So I'm like super bullish if you're, no matter what you're doing, build some cool tools and market them. And look, if you can't get people to use the free tools and link to them, you're not going to get people to use the paid tools.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, this is my point. A lot of marketing, for us, it's like all marketing is not about attribution, and it's not about making decisions based on data, and it's not about measuring the impact on the bottom line, but more so about intuition, common sense, and just observing, like, you did this, what kind of influence did we see? Did we see more traffic? Did we see more signups? Did we see more sales? But you don't necessarily need to put it into specific numbers. So you do need to know that it works. You do need to see like uplifts here and there. But if it converts at 7% or 6%, I don't care, because I either know what I can do about this tool to make it better, or I don't know. And like, seeing the number won't magically give me ideas of how it could be better. I either have those ideas and I should do them, or I don't.
Yep.
That is my marketing philosophy. So let's talk a little bit about growth hacking, because in 2019, you tweeted, growth hacking is a con, set of tactics used by charlatans of the old web to trick people into taking action, spam users, and ultimately help VCs punt the ball forward on valuations. It's also now a dead tactic. Future of marketing is building trust. You cannot fake this for long. I love that. I hate when people use kind of different loopholes to try to propel their business or company forward. But it's 2019, so it's like almost 4 years ago. But I wonder if there is anything specific that made you want to tweet that. Did you see someone doing some blatantly unethical thing?
There's not one person. I would say the ongoing, there was someone last week who literally tweeted how they stole however many, I don't know if you saw this, they stole a bunch of competitor traffic. It's like hacking is not should not be the ethos of great marketing. Great marketing is building a relationship with the customer and having respect for them, not trying to use leverage to borrow against your futures to beat numbers this quarter that are unsustainable, right? It's you want to be in a more sustainable growth mindset versus what can we do to cheat the system to get ahead. Now, that's not to say don't come up with clever ways to grow. I just don't think the hacking part is necessarily the right ethos. So I wrote a post on this and I said, look, the original growth hacking, quote unquote, was things like Microsoft putting at the bottom of every email, this was sent by a Hotmail account, sign up for Hotmail. And I don't think that's growth hacking. I think that's just good marketing. I think marketers just lacked a name for a lot of the things that were done online. And so people like to, as the tech industry does, we like to come up with different new buzzwords and phrases for things. Oh, it's growth hacking, or I'm a growth ninja or whatever. But really, at the end of the day, what you're doing is marketing. You're doing some sort of marketing. I guess for me, it's when the types of companies that I work on wouldn't survive if they were always reliant upon some sort of trickery or fakery to always get ahead. There has to be a legitimate product there or a legitimate use case. And it turns out that the more utility and the more use and the higher stickiness of your product, the less you need to hack your way to get there. I think you can do things like that for a short period of time, where you saw Blue Apron was giving free meals to people for a while on VentureBucks to try to seem larger than they were and to try to become this habit for people where you get your food delivered. And it turns out a lot of people were just signing up for the free meal kit. And so all of it, like Blue Apron's a great example because they went IPO, and basically if you had put any money into them at all, you basically would have lost like 90% of it or whatever amount. And that sort of marketing where you're purely using money as an accelerator. And look, I'm an ad guy, so I'm about using money to get there faster. But there's probably some like rate of growth that makes sense for your company at the stage that you're at and the product that you're at. And if you try to bite off more than that, you're going to end up in a situation where one of two things are going to happen. Those users are going to churn and they're not going to come back. Or in some situations, maybe it's probably less true for software, but if you like do something that goes super viral and you have a physical world product, what if you get too much demand and your warehouse doesn't have enough inventory? You sell out and now you just frustrate all of those people that just tried to order and they don't want to buy from you later. So I just think a lot of the pure growth hack stuff is very exploitive, short-term. I don't think that the tactics need to be bad, but just make sure they're part of some long-term plan that you've thought through to second and third order effects and what's going to happen, not just next quarter, but next year from the things you're doing. There's just so many examples of growth hacking gone bad. I don't know that we need to go through more. I think like people know when they're doing things they shouldn't be doing, especially I've built enough websites for fun and profit where like I did things that were black hat and eventually I got smacked down by the search gods. And eventually like the sites that I built where I just added content and built links, like those ones still make me money today. So I don't know what the incentive is. I guess if you really were under the gun to do better right now or your wrists are going to be slit or something, okay. But other than that, I just don't see the upside.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Looking for growth hacks all the time and exploiting them until they shut down by the kind of parent platform that you're exploiting is probably not the smartest marketing strategy. But speaking of the smartest marketing strategy, in the past 4 or 5 years, you worked in 4 different companies, right? In Vitae, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Think3, Lex, and now AdQuick. Speaking of great marketing, you said marketing that builds trust. I wonder, what are the staples of Adam's marketing strategy? What is your playbook? Like when you go from company to company, what are the kind of, playbook, critical things, the most important things that you take care of for each company?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really, your series of tactics is dictated by the stage of the company more than anything else. And so that's for a few reasons. That's due to budget, that's due to what you should be doing at a given company size. So a company that's about to go IPO, their marketing looks a lot different than a company who's acquiring their first 100 customers, or a company that is already a big public company with many customers. So it really depends on the company size. And so it, for my personal history, I've worked at a few different companies because of COVID, startup life, a bunch of other reasons. One of those gigs was actually really just a consultant role where I helped 20 different portfolio companies of private equity. One of those was a biotech company where if it worked out, they'd be really big. It didn't work out. There is zero. That's what happens in biotech. It's either works or it doesn't. And Lex was also an early stage bet where they actually got acquired. So it is what it is. We decided to sell the companies. Those are mixed outcomes for some of those. VTech was the worst outcome, but not really the fault of marketing. But really, yeah, for when you go into a company, when you get to be an old like we are, and you've seen companies of all stages and teams of all stages, just know what the stage of the company is at, know what the goals of the company are. Make sure that you're resourced in such a way you're going to get close to those goals. I think good leadership has ambitious goals. So their goals should be ahead of what you can deliver, but make sure that they're going to give you the money for ad spend and for tools and for team members to get to the numbers. And if not, you need to, when you're in the interview phase of a company, like I've learned this, I've worked for enough places now, you say, okay, what's our resourcing look like? And what are your expectations? And if the expectations are way beyond what they're going to resource you for, big red flag, don't work for that company. It's going to be misalignment between everyone. They're going to frustrate you. You're going to frustrate them. And so, yeah, it comes down to company stage and resourcing and expectations. And then for me personally, I see marketing as a bit of a triage problem. So I have a sense of urgency when I work on marketing. There's infinite things you could do now. So I tend to step into a team and I triage the problems. Like, let's start with the simple things, like starting with, does my website convert? Are there any technical SEO problems? None of this is in order. Do I have a great email nurture track? Do I have wonderful ads that tell the story? Am I consistently updating social? All of the different things that need to go into a great marketing program. And I'll triage those and create a roadmap based on that. And once you've got the blocking and tackling right, which you need to do first, and all your ad stack is speaking to each other and you're starting to run, now you can start to think more creatively about the narrative that you want to put into the world and what you want people to do and how you want to change an industry. But I don't think you can do that until you're actually running first and have a good good processes set up. Like, you can't do these big ambitious things like change the narrative of an industry if you can't send good emails, right? You have to be able to do the simple stuff first, and then you can do the bigger ambitious stuff. I think tooling, we talked about public tools. You guys are great at it. The tools are actually, Chris and my team built all those. I think that those are pretty sophisticated tactics. I think you don't get to build tools. Like, a marketing team doesn't get resource from Edge to build tools unless you've built the right permission with your leadership that they're going to give you Edge people to work on. So it's definitely something where if you are a marketing team and you don't have Edge resource, build that trust with your executive team and with your product team so you can get some to build tools. And so I think that's like a super bullish signal. If you're interviewing somewhere, if they have tools that are public, that shows they're investing in really cool inbound marketing tactics. They're probably pretty sophisticated and they're probably a fun company to work for.
I also like your advice to just focus on the simple fundamentals. Make sure you're sending good emails. Make sure that the copy on your homepage is clear. Make sure that you update your socials with whatever people are expecting from your company. And yeah, I like how you segue that into getting permission to do more kind of risky / creative, uncommon stuff that you might necessarily be able to persuade your management as easy. But if you take care of the basics and you show your stakeholders or boss or clients that the way you handle those fundamentals works, then they would definitely have more trust in you to let you do things that are not that easy to prove the efficacy of.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised at the number of marketers that like don't even do the basics really well and consistently. Get that stuff in order and walk before you run.
So
let's talk about Twitter, since you mentioned socials. Our Twitter profiles couldn't be more different. My tweets are predominantly about our product. I try to share some stuff or ideas about marketing. You tweet about whatever is on your mind. Like you tweet a lot about politics, you tweet about hot trends, you And you have a tweet again from 2018. Where you said
this should be fun.
Marketers don't get Twitter because most don't bother to engage with other communities besides marketing here. That's me. To Meta, this place much more diverse, every niche and interest represented. Has been the case since the 90s. Most of the sector doesn't get digital communities because they don't participate. So yeah, like you clearly have a lot more followers than me, you get a lot more engagement than me. So like your strategy definitely works. But I wonder, what's your thought process, if there's any at all, or you're just like having fun? Do you see Twitter as a marketing tool for the business that you work at? Because I think I only saw one or two tweets about AdQuick from you at all. You don't promote the product as much.
So I actually really like your Twitter account, by the way. That was not a subtweet of you. I follow you. No,
it was from 2018. It was from 2018. I don't see it as a personal attack.
No, so I actually tweet all of our product launches and product news. Twitter's algo is not going to show you everything I tweet, but I'm not on Twitter to like promote any company or anything like that. I use Twitter because I like to have a narrative of the world, and I've been a blogger about digital trends, philosophy, marketing, everything under the sun since 2003, 2004. But I share what are major product milestones. I think anyone who's an interesting person online probably has a day job or probably does something else. And I think I don't want to overly promote buy our software now. I don't think that's not what you're doing on Twitter either. So not really what I'm talking about when I'm like, marketers just come in to share their company press releases. Like no one would want to follow someone who did that. But there are marketers who do that, and then they get basically no engagement. But I do think in social, people are coming to interact with other people. And then ultimately, I think you'll earn the permission to sell into people. Whether you're like always tweeting about your specific company or not, I think that we tend to buy from people we trust. But I'm, as a marketer, my levers in the world are things like ads, email, search, like any of my personal accounts are to talk to industry and friends. But unless you're Elon and you're like CEO of the company, I don't think your personal team members.
Wait. Elon was my next question. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
If you're a CEO and you want to, I guess we'll skip to this question, but I don't think any single person, even your marketing team members, are going to get you there on social alone. I think it's a nice ad if you have people that are active online. But what you need from them is they need to be able to jockey the right internet tools that can reach your market at scale. And so they're just gravy if you hire people who are active online. I tend to bias because I'm working on internet marketing tools. So I want marketers who are using internet marketing tools personally. And so like we have a bias there, but it's so meta. Like for other companies, it probably doesn't matter as much. For us, it does. But for other things, if you're in a past life, I was marketing International Dairy Queen, Olive Garden, Darden restaurants. I was marketing like a lot of food companies, like a lot of QSRs, quick serve restaurants and chain restaurants. And I wouldn't need to be extremely online to market those things. It would help, but like it wouldn't matter. Do I know how to make a fun commercial that gets people hype about going to get breadsticks and salad? That's really my job, and that's just going to make the company billions of dollars. But for us, we should be extremely online. But we're weird. Most people don't do what we do. So,
do you have any strategy with your personal Twitter at all? Do you take, I don't know, a few hours on Monday to schedule some tweets?
No.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that way, but I just had to ask because some people are saying like you have to tweet every day or take time to find ideas. And now there are those tools that help you ideate tweets where you don't have anything to say.
If you need a tool for social media to share what you think, you probably shouldn't use social media. You don't need to. Come on.
I love that. So basically, you're in the moment whatever comes to your mind, you just tweet it. You don't like do like in advance, or I need like a plan of what I'm going to post on socials. I need to stay relevant. I need to be interesting. I need to consistently come up with ideas for people.
Come up with ideas. You're killing me.
Yeah, like whenever I try to schedule some tweets and ideas in advance, whenever I try to force myself to tweet something,
They're not good.
Yeah. Whenever I'm in the moment.
Yeah, if you're going to write like a 500-word blog post, of course, you're going to work on that. It's going to take a while. But for social, it's like the best ones are like your random thoughts.
Yeah. And whenever on Twitter, I just feel, oh, I have something interesting that I think people on Twitter would love. I just tweet it in the moment and it gets attention. Whenever I try to strategically plan, okay, let me try to tweet something every day this week. Yeah, it's like complete shit. But one thing I don't quite get, and I got a little bit of pushback on Twitter for this, because the other day I was scrolling my feed and I saw some people who I followed for SEO advice share, I don't know, their dogs, their like recipes or whatever coffee they were ordering. And in that moment, I made a tweet like people should be more aware of what other people follow them for. And if I followed you for your marketing knowledge and acumen, I don't necessarily want to see you like, I don't know, your cup of coffee in Starbucks or anything. And some people didn't like that. Some people didn't like that. They said that I don't get the concept of social, that people want to share their lives. So I'm still not quite in peace with that notion, because thinking of myself, people follow me for my marketing knowledge, for my SEO advice, and because I work at Ahrefs and I can share some interesting stuff that is happening in the company or give them a few tips. But I'm not like, I'm not Will Smith. I'm not a celebrity that people follow famous for being famous. This is why I feel it is odd if I would just tweet, oh, like I just got my best coffee in Singapore, and share a nice picture of me like drinking coffee in some. It feels odd. I wonder what are your thoughts about this?
I want to see you drinking coffee in Singapore. Actually, like some of the views from those buildings are super cool. I bet like people would love to see like some of the cool like infrastructure and architecture that you get to see on a daily basis. I think it's fun. I think posting a little bit of your personal life humanizes you. It really depends if you want to keep it where it's just purely your work and purely about the things you do that are related to your industry. I think that's fine. I think like some of the most memorable things online probably have to do more with if you were to post one of your old DJ sets or something. I think that would probably be like something I would remember if you had done that. I don't think there's anything wrong with being human as well. If you're just posting pictures of your coffee like every single day, that would get annoying. I might unfollow or mute you if you did something like that. But I don't think there's anything wrong with sharing a bit of who you are. Again, to your point, it wouldn't be something planned. So I think if someone planned that to try to sculpt how people view of you, I think that's weird versus, oh, something fun happened at the airport or like someone was like, maybe there was a cool out of home ad and you took a photo of that, right? So that's
here you go.
if it's organic and it's like, the word's cliche, but some cliches are there for a reason. It's if it's authentic and real and it comes off that way, then I think it's a good thing. And I think it matters more if you're selling even more of a commodified good. So if you're selling something people can get the same version of in 50 places, but they want to buy from you because they like you more, it might make more sense for your company to humanize more. If you guys have the hottest product that everyone freaking loves, then you guys can just, you probably don't have to do that. You can humanize the company as much as you want, but since your tools are so good, like you don't need to either way. So it's up to you what you want to do. I think there's like different selling strategies. And also it's what's the culture of the company. So I tweet sometimes fun memes or politics stuff, which I have fun with. But if I was at a company where like leadership wasn't fun and I tweeted some of the things I knew, they might get mad. But here's the rub. Like, they wouldn't have hired me if like I'm myself online. Yeah. So they like know what they're getting. So I'm like self-selecting out by being myself online, by ensuring
I don't work with people who aren't like, oh, Adam Swan and Adam like talks like this and has opinions on certain things. Like, it's known and out there. So that's probably one of the other upsides for sharing ideas online. But again, I'm weird. I've been a blogger since the early days of blogging, and I've just done the same thing I did on that blog, just on Twitter and Substack now. But I've had strong opinions held strongly on the internet forever. So,
okay, Elon, we got to Elon.
All right.
Again, here's what you tweeted. From a marketing perspective, Elon shitposting Tesla all the way to $6 billion market cap is perhaps the greatest triumph of social media for business.
100%.
Does anyone even know what other automakers or their executives post online? Can anyone who doesn't cover auto sector even name another CEO?
Zero chance.
This is from 2021. These days, Elon is getting a lot of heat. I wonder if Elon getting himself in the problems he got himself today with, as you pointed out, shitposting. Like, how do you feel about what is happening right now to Elon and his shenanigans?
He needs, at some point, he needs a filter. And to, I think he's gotten to the point he has without anyone telling him what to do. Because they're like, you're Elon and look what you've done. Like, who am I to ever say what you should do? And I think, like, at some point, it would be good if Elon had an advisor who was like, okay, you're at like, Elon, you're at like a 12 all the time. Like, how do we get you to like a 9 or 10 or like an 8? I don't know. If Elon was just working on electric cars and space and whatever else, and he never tweeted, I think like there would be a lot less animosity. But he is on the spectrum. And what people don't understand is he's our generation's Howard Hughes. If you've ever watched the movie The Aviator, great movie, Leo, or you know who Howard Hughes was. And he was an iconoclast inventor. And I think modernity is struggling to understand that you don't get people with crazy, insane ideas that don't also have probably some demons that they're fighting. It's not normal. If like a normal person made 50 million or whatever Elon made with PayPal, they would be on an island sipping margaritas.
Yeah.
Like a normal person doesn't decide, oh, okay, I'm going to go build like electric car maker, launch rockets to space. But society doesn't like the fact that the weird people do these things. They're supposed to follow a script or follow into a certain lane. And normal people don't do those things. So I think there's this push pull. I wonder what we could do to come to terms with that more. I don't know. It's like a complicated problem. It might be unsolvable. I'm just surprised people don't understand that those things go together. And so I'm willing to, like, Elon has said things that definitely upset me before, but I'm willing to let it roll because he does all this other stuff that has upside for the world. And it seems like there's bigger things to be upset at than like Elon's rogue tweets. Who cares? I don't know. Maybe because I've been on the internet so long, I'm so numb to it. And I'm like, well, don't we have more important stuff to worry about? But I don't know.
I feel very similar to yourself in that regard. But one of the reasons I do feel like that, and I don't give that much weight to some of the like jokes and things that Elon is saying, is because I have a history of getting in trouble for saying something on the internet, and people were completely blowing it out of proportion. So what I had in my head while saying it and how people were reacting to it were not proportionate. So it wouldn't happen in real life. If I was with a room with people and we were having a conversation, it wouldn't happen. But because it's an internet and tweets are short, they lack context, they lack understanding of a person, the human being that you're talking to and where they're coming from, and a lot of other things. And because I was getting in trouble, I think unfairly, the way people reacted is not what I meant happening. I can see how this could be happening to Elon while he was in one state of mind while he was saying something, but people turn it around completely differently. But he also has demons, that's for sure. It definitely isn't helping. But overall, I think, speaking of marketing, I think it's such a powerful marketing, tool or channel or strategy, whatever you call it, when the CEO or founder of a company can have a voice, because people tune in and listen. So I'm CMO at Ahrefs, and I have something like, I don't know, 5 times more followers on Twitter than Dmitry, our CEO and founder, has. But it is so much easier for him to get more exposure than I do because of who he is. And yeah, like you mentioned in your tweet about, does anyone even know any of the CEOs in the auto sector because they're not vocal, they're not using themselves as a marketing tool?
No one could name them.
Yeah. But I think it is so powerful when a person who is behind doing something cool, building a cool company with a huge following or customer base, can talk publicly.
So this is the double-edged sword. He shitposted the way to $600 billion. But because he did that and he didn't know where the line was, he's probably also cost himself some market share. I think it's still a huge opportunity for normal CEOs that maybe aren't even as iconoclast as Elon to just do a good job, to just show up on social, do a good job, be a human, like tweet cool stories about your company, share a little bit of insight in your personal life. And I think it can be a great tool for you to really get to know the people behind your brand. And so that, again, double-edged sword though. For a CEO, you definitely want to be doing this more thoughtfully than us on the marketing team, where for marketers, like, our job is to test a bunch of stuff. Our job is to poke and find the line. For the CEO, I'm not sure that's the case. I think that's really for the marketing team. That's not for someone else. Hey, I'm not going to critique what Elon is doing. He's built almost a $1 trillion auto company. So he knows, he has a plan in his head, I think.
Yeah. But I also think that there's just no way to not get into trouble as your audience gets bigger.
Oh, yeah.
There's just, like, right now, no matter how hard Elon tries to tweet something with the sole goal of this tweet shouldn't offend anyone and shouldn't cause any controversy. If he had an entire team of advisors working on a tweet like that, some people would still get unhappy. And I get it with myself. Like, the more people know me and the bigger my audience gets, the higher the chance that someone would misunderstand something I'm saying and would cause drama because of it. So I think it's just inevitable that sooner or later you'll get into trouble if you do this.
Yeah, for someone like you, anything anyone thinks is your risk is zero. I don't worry about anything you would say. Those people are crazy. You don't have to worry.
But an example I have in my head is the Basecamp guys.
Oh, yeah.
So they've built an incredible personal brand through thought leadership and through doing great work with their company.
They're awesome.
With tech and all of that. I read, I think, if not all, but most of the books they published. And I love their ideology. I have a tremendous respect for them. But then what it was like last year, they got in trouble for some policy of not discussing politics at work. And suddenly everyone turned on them. It was quite crazy.
I don't think they lost any users, or if they lost any, it was multiple. Yeah. Those guys have been, everyone's political crazy too. I think we're at just a weird point where people are trying to find things to get mad at when it's probably not that big of a deal. And I think we actually passed peak getting mad at things, peak cancel culture, and things are going to get saner. I think it's like such a waste of time. Like, everyone needs to get bigger problems.
Okay, this was great. Let me recap with one kind of final question to wrap up a lot of the topics and discussions that we had. And this would be, again, back to marketing data, analytics, attribution. So how important is it really for marketing teams and marketing leaders to use that and to track that?
Yeah, I think it's important. It's more important the larger you are, really, because the larger your company is and the more you spend and the more channels you're running, you need to understand how effective they all are and how they work in harmony. But I would say for a smaller company, start, because you want to build that habit and you want to have the culture of analytics, the culture of measurement from the early days. So as you scale up, it can be done in such a way you already have marketing accountability built into what your executives expect,
And the reason you want to do this as a marketer is because you don't want the question getting thrown back at you of, is my marketing working? It's working. The company's growing. You have new users. You're the marketing team. Where else are they coming from? It's just good for everyone. But I think as you just start with minimum viable analytics, like measure sales, revenue, conversions, and everything like before that, make sure that you're looking at it as a marketing team, but you don't have to, I think the more sophisticated your team is as marketers, like the more you look at the indicator metrics, this indicators, you're like, oh yeah, these are headed the right way. And you're not going to kill yourself on reporting. The companies that can spend a lot of time reporting just have more resources. They're spending millions of dollars on ads and they have a big marketing team so they can allocate resource there. It's a first pass problem to have. And so you want to get to that point, but I would say bias to shipping. I've never seen a company that didn't ship consistently good things, good emails, good social posts, good blog posts, kill themselves over analytics, and they usually do quite well. So yeah, I just think as you grow bigger, it matters more, but build the muscle while you're smaller.
Great way to end our conversation. Adam, thanks a lot for coming. It was great. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, Sim. This is awesome.